The Guardian.
Welcome to another Film Weekly. Big Daddy's back, it's me, Jason Solomons. This week I meet Mila Kunis, the actress playing a twinkle-toed temptress in Darren Aronofsky's ballet psychodrama Black Swan. We've got live banjo from Josh Fox, whose documentary Gasland explores the exploding problem of pollution from reckless gas mining in America. It's on its way here too. And of course, myself and Zam Brooks will be looking at the week's releases, including Peter Mullen's searing return with Neds, Robert Duvall and Bill Murray in Get Low, and Shameless star Gerard Kearns getting dumped in British indie Honeymooner. Yes, sleepless nights and nappies couldn't stop me. It's Film Weekly. Black Swan is the latest film from the wrestler director Darren Aronofsky. It stars Natalie Portman and Mila Kunis in a psychological thriller with ballet shoes. It's the story of a gifted young New York dancer, Nina, on the cusp of greatness as she stars in a new version of Swan Lake. Nina, however, is dogged by paranoia and the sudden emergence of a new dancer, Lily, played by Kunis, who oozes sensuality and abandon, just the things Nina desires.
Hey. You okay? You can't smoke in here.
Well, I won't tell if you won't.
So, big day's getting closer and closer, huh? Well, I can't wait. I think you're gonna be amazing.
Thanks.
So, do you want to talk about it?
Is that our day?
Well, we're playing a little too rough for you.
Come on, Nina, he's brilliant.
Sure, but it's not like he's all warm and fuzzy.
Well, you don't know it.
Someone's hot for teacher.
Oh, come on, it's okay. I don't blame you.
I should go home.
Oh, Nina, come on, I'm just playing around.
Mila Kunis and Golden Globe winner Natalie Portman there in Black Swan, garnering nominations and awards all over the place. Could be a big winner at this year's Oscars. I met up with Mila Kunis, fast becoming a Hollywood A-lister and winning awards herself. Most recently, the Mastroianni Award at the Venice Film Festival, where Black Swan was the opening film. We talked about her role in Black Swan, and I began by asking her if when she took the part, she realised just how intense the film would turn out to be.
I don't think you're ever fully aware of exactly how things turn out. Sometimes they exceed your expectations, sometimes they don't, and this, couldn't have exceeded my expectations anymore.
So what did you know going into it? You knew what sort of character you were playing? Because your first entrance is like kind of, she's trouble, she comes in with her iPod, she kind of puts Natalie off her, one of her points and makes her fall down, and you always think, oh, that she's going to be a troublesome girl. What did you know about your part?
Exactly what you just said. I mean, it's the character is real in most scenes, and in other scenes it's a perception of what Natalie thinks of her, and so it's kind of just playing the both aspects of her. Mm-hmm. So it was fun.
Yeah, what did they say? Well, you're going to be the evil twin. Did you think, well, thanks for that?
It wasn't really said to me that way. It was just more like the yin to somebody's yang.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Which is, and that's definitely how the film plays out. The whole ballet thing, are you a ballerina from training? Or?
No, I never did ballet until I started doing ballet for the film.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Never. I mean, I think when I was like maybe 7, 8, I took a ballet class as a little kid, but right, not to the point of knowing anything.
So can you just tell me how you just learn ballet? Because you look like, you know, I'm no ballet expert, obviously, because I think you look like to the manner born, and I'm sure some strict ballerina instructor will tell me that you're not quite right. But what did you have to go through to learn all that?
I had 3 months of training before production started, and I trained 7 days a week, 4 hours a day.
Wow. That's dedication. That's good.
Yeah.
Right. You deserve an award for that.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
How are your feet after all that?
They were a little beaten up for a while after. For a while after, they were a little messed up.
Mm-hmm. And playing with Natalie Portman, I don't know if you knew her beforehand. Had you ever worked with her before? And did you always knew that it was going to be her that was you're going to be your you were the yang to her yin or the yin to her yang?
Yeah, I've known Natalie for a couple of years. So I think she was attached to the project for many years before I was. So yeah, I knew. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What did you two do to kind of get into the vibe? Because you have to befriend her, but she's a kind of a difficult character to befriend in this.
Well, I mean, I think we were both lucky in the sense of we knew each other for many years before we started the project. So there was already that type of connection. So it made things a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, when we were shooting, we kind of just shot it every which way and had fun with it.
Because that's the other thing about this film. It's striking. The story is striking and the kind of, you know, the kind of fantastic kind of element of it. But it's also very loose. You don't normally see this kind of loose kind of indie style of filmmaking in this kind of genre at all. Yeah. So there's always that. What was it that way? Was it shot that way? It looks very kind of like be anywhere.
It was shot handheld. It was shot by Darren. You know, he had a very specific style and a very specific look to everything. So yeah, I mean, we knew when we were shooting with handheld, the thing about it is you never know what's being seen. There's not really a shot list per se because it's moving around constantly. So it always kept us on our toes.
Yeah, literally.
Literally.
See what you did there. tell me a bit about you because I found out that you weren't born in the States. You were actually born in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
And when did you go over to the States?
When I was seven.
Seven. So you spoke Russian until you were seven?
Yeah. And
you still do?
Yeah.
At home you speak Russian?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's good. Do you want to use your Russian again?
Maybe one day if the right role comes around, sure.
Because you moved to California, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Moved to LA when I was seven.
Right, because then you get the feeling she's from San Francisco in this movie. But yeah. I've always thought of you as a kind of New Yorker. I don't know why.
You know, a lot of people do. Because I've always said that I'm not very LA, but the one major thing LA about me is my coffee order. It's really LA.
What is that?
It's an awful order from Starbucks that couldn't be any more obnoxious. But
tell me.
Okay, it's a venti iced vanilla latte sugar free with soy with half the pumps. It's a horrible order. And I'm constantly embarrassed by it. And every time I walk into Starbucks, I rattle it off as fast as I can, and then I whisper it. It's so bad, and it's so embarrassing. But that's, I would say, the most LA thing about it.
Is that what you drank on set here at the Making Black Swan?
Oh, yeah, a lot of it.
That's your drink. You're not moving.
You know, sometimes I like to, okay, I'll tell you, when I'm in New York and I can't order it because people look at you and they scoff at you like, what is this order you do? So I usually just take it down to just a latte versus everything else that comes along with it. So it makes things a lot easier.
Plus in New York, things are busy. No one's got time to make that stuff.
No one's got time to listen to my order because it takes about 30 minutes for me to rattle it off. My God, it's a horrible order.
It's nice to see you because I saw you in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, obviously. I thought you were terrific in that. I really enjoyed you. I was like, who's this girl? She's great. And then someone said, well, it's the girl from Family Guy. Which, of course, we never see you in Family Guy. Yeah. How do you – I mean, a lot of people you're actually sort of quite famous through Family Guy. Is that kind of weird, being known for your voice? Because that's why I sort of comment on the accent and the voice. And, you know, it's kind of something you must be very conscious of because you use that almost more than your body.
You know what? I've always been more recognized for my voice than I ever have for what I look like. Even when I was in school, I have a pretty specific identifiable voice. So I've always said as long I can go out in public anywhere, as long as I don't open my mouth and speak, no one's going to ever recognize me. But so I'm aware. Yeah. My voice has always been pretty specific.
Hey, Brian, in hopes that you'll open your heart to God, I wanted to give you this cross.
No, I don't want a cross.
Would you want it if I threw it over there?
No, please don't do that.
You gonna get it, boy?
No, please, no.
Go get it, boy!
And do you think this is because you kind of had to learn American in some kind of way? I don't know how you learned it, but at 7 years old, you had to kind of learn American and fast.
Right. I mean, I think the younger you are, the easier it is to pick up a language. I mean, I do believe a kid has no fear, so they just kind of immerse themselves and learn it. No, I just think I was born with a very specific voice. Like, my voice has just always been very loud. I think at one point Seth MacFarlane was quoted saying that my voice can pierce through a G4 engine. I was like, thanks for that. It's a pretty specific voice.
And are you like this in Russian? Say something in Russian. Say, it's nice to see you and I love Black Swan, the movie, in Russian.
Хорошо тебя видеть, и мне очень нравится Black Swan.
There you go. It's pretty similar. It's kind of softer.
Only because I said it softer. Russian's a really harsh language. If you ever see my family and I converse, we constantly look like we're fighting. Really, we're just loving each other.
Now, I was Googling you before I came. I said I must find out a bit more about Mila Kunis because I'm no great expert in your work. And you're also a newcomer. You know, you're the new talent winner of the Mastroianni Award. So, then, you know, I'm forgiven to not know your entire work, although I loved you in Book of Eli, too. And you know what comes up? It comes up Hot Jewish Girls of the World, right?
Yeah, woo!
So for me, this is very exciting. I present Sounds Jewish. I do the film show, but I also present a film show called Sounds Jewish. So for me, this is one of the best Shabbases I've ever had, you know? Because there's you, there's Darren Aronofsky. Then I'm thinking, oh, no, who else is on the Hot Jewish Girls? Mm-hmm. There's you, there's Natalie Portman, there's Jennifer Connelly, there's Rachel Weisz. And I'm thinking, there's one person at the center of this world, and that's Darren Aronofsky.
Yeah. He did. He surrounded himself with a lot of Jews.
Is Vincent Cassel is also Jewish. Certainly the character he plays in La Haine is Jewish. I think he's Jewish. Barbara Hershey.
Yeah, we're everywhere. The Jews are, you know, we are everywhere. Yeah.
What was it? You couldn't get the rehearsal space on Saturdays? He gave everyone a day off?
I'm not sure if we're practicing Jews, but we're Jews.
Yeah, well, you don't need to practice it. You look brilliant in this film. I really enjoyed it. It's one of my kind of favourite films of the year, kind of like straight in there. Mila Kunis, absolute pleasure to see you and I thought, you're so beautiful, we should have you on camera. But as you say, your voice is more famous, so to have you on the podcast, absolute pleasure.
There you go. Thank you.
And if you want to hear and see my interview with Darren Aronofsky, he's part of my In the Director's Chair series, currently showing on guardian.co.uk/In the Director's Chair. Now, speaking of beautiful faces with recognisable voices, Zan Brooks pirouettes into the podcast studio to review some of this week's releases. Zan, we'll look at Black Swan. I'll tell you about Honeymooner. We'll talk about Neds by Peter Mullen. Maybe a bit of Spit on Your Grave. And you can tell me about Get Low as well. But let's start with Black Swan. Does this have you goosebumps all over you?
Yeah, goosebumps and bleeding eyes and a terrible clammy nervousness.
Yeah, which I actually had during The Wrestler as well, which I think Darren Aronofsky.
Well, it's a weird companion piece, isn't it? They should show them on, as a double bill. I thought Black Swan was great. I mean, it's a sort of malarial melodrama, backstage melodrama with a sort of dash of Grand Guignol.
Yeah, and when you say great, you mean great as in, Gone with the Wind, or it's going to last forever?
I prefer
or
it to Gone with the Wind,
right,
I think.
Exactly.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's a masterpiece necessarily, and it's certainly a film that has divided people. Some people absolutely hate it.
Really?
And see,
ballerinas tend to hate it.
Ballerinas, but it's been accused of a kind of misogyny as well, in that it's basically painting these ballerinas, you know, who would have thought, as a sort of bunch of jittery neurotics whose dearest wish is to die for their male director.
Yeah.
So in that regard, it's possibly a bit dodgy. I mean, it's crass. It's a bit trashy. Yeah. It reminded me a little bit of the video for Billy Idol's White Wedding at times. Nice day for that. But for all that, it worked for me in the moment, and it left an impression.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's terrific fun for me. I know some people have gone for, but I've seen women come out of screenings of this and kind of going, oh, that's me, that's the sacrifices I make for my work as well. So I don't think there is a misogyny. I think there's almost sort of a deep understanding of some of the commitment involved in not just ballerina, but in art
in general.
Well,
in the same way that the greatest ballet movie of all time, The Red Shoes, the Paul Pressburger film from the late 40s, did the same thing. It is about the kind of the pull of duty and art, and where do you kind of find that balance, and how far are you willing to go to achieve perfection?
Exactly, and I think that's clearly what the film is about. It had me kind of my nails were kind of torn. I was my feet hurt whenever I watch ballet films. I always think, oh my God, how do they do that with their nails? But it literally, you know, it has you on the edge of your seat as they're on the edge of their toes. You know, I think it worked beautifully as a kind of bit of tension, a bit of fun, if you like, but in that psychological horror kind of
vein. Yeah. I mean, we're saying the Red Shoes, but it's like the Red Shoes dragged through the sewers of New York and kind of grimed up a bit. And it's also been kind of crossbred with Polanski's Repulsion.
Yeah.
It has that same creeping kind of constricting terror to it as well.
Yeah, and I mean, it has sexual tension. It has an all-out
drug use.
It has drug use.
Barbara Hershey as the sort of mad, overbearing
terrific
mum.
But clearly, Grand Guignol, as you say, kind of asking. Well, I was going to say it's kind of all about Eve in a tutu, and then you think of Barbara Hershey, and she's got that Bette Davis kind of thing.
Baby
going
Jane,
on. Yeah,
going on there.
And let's talk about Neds by Peter Mullen, a director who I think is one of the fieriest presence in world cinema. In fact, it's been a long time since we've seen him. So let's delve into that Glasgow of the 70s, where John, played by Conor McCarron, a newcomer, is being nabbed by the bobbies.
Is this one of them?
No. No, he's not one of them.
You better not be pissing me about, son.
What are you running for?
Don't know. Where'd you stay?
Dove Street.
What's your name?
Name? John McGill.
You sure he was the one of them?
I'm not repeating this out of you, you prick.
You fucking with me, son. I'll come back and do you worse than those boys ever could.
Peter Mullen, I think, an incendiary presence. His first film, Orphans, was a great night out in Glasgow. Dark, blackly comic. And then Magdalene Sisters, 2002. Isn't it a brilliant film? Mm. It won the Golden Lion at Venice, a tale of abuse amongst Irish Catholic nuns. And, I mean, I think amazing. And then he disappeared for 8 years. How can a British director, Scottish man, win such a great award, prestigious award, and then be allowed to disappear for
eight years?
Well,
I think he's going for the Terence Davis Award, isn't he? Which is the award that no one wants, which is, you know, the greatest filmmaker who never makes films.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose it's good. I mean, he's contributed kind of typically incandescent performances to, like, Children of Men and Young Adam in the meantime.
Harry Potter, I noticed.
Well, perhaps that's what's funding something like Ned's, although it seems to me that it was made for, like, $3.
Yeah.
Ned's. Yeah, it starred, as we heard, Conor McCarron. There are lots of unknown Scottish, well, kids, basically.
Yeah.
Which really reminded me of a sort of Sweet 16, the Ken Loach film that sort of pursued that was around the same time as My Name Is Joe.
Reminded me of that. It also reminded me of Small Faces, the Gillies McKinnon film from about sort of 10, 15 years ago, which is also
filmmakers.
Set in 70s Glasgow. Also, a little bit at times, The Butcher Boy,
yeah.
The Neil Jordan film, with it sort of, you know, that portrait of adolescent madness and loneliness. It's got a terrible grinding loneliness at the heart of this film. Mm. It's basically the miseducation of this bright Catholic school kid,
yes,
played by Conor McCarron.
Yes,
John McGill,
you're right, absolutely.
Who goes kind of off the rails and becomes a non-educational delinquent. But then also just becomes a kind of outcast and wanders the streets. And there's great, you know, it's total British social realism, this, but there's these amazing little hallucinatory fantasy sequences at one stage with a naked, violent Jesus who accosts him.
Yeah, I mean, there are many sequences. There are grimness. There's the Council of States and runs and chases through it. But there are moments where it sort of veers into a John Carpenter-type kind of Halloween slasher movie as well.
It's a very odd film, this. Mm. I mean, it's a little bit raw and unschooled, and there's the sense that Mullen isn't entirely sure where he's going with this. But that's a good thing as well, because it makes it turbulent. You kind of feel that this film could sort of explode or melt down at any point.
That's exactly it. It's almost like an adolescent. It's like, you know, for one moment it's calm and funny and kind of charming, and then it's vicious.
And you never know what's going to kind of trip it.
Yeah, and you don't really. It's one of those films. I just like. I do not know where this film is going, which is really refreshing.
And where it's going is to a great final scene. This very strange final scene on a safari park.
Isn't it brilliant?
Which is just one of the great endings of recent British film.
Yeah, it's kind of. It actually sort of is. It's not the right. It sort of seems that that's in the wrong order. A bit like No Country for Old Men. It sort of stops this film. And you think, oh, right, okay.
Yeah, and then only afterwards you realise that's the perfect ending.
Yeah, isn't it? And Mullen himself is...
Mullen is great. I mean, he's got about three lines.
I know, but he's...
But,
I think he's actually uncredited. I was looking on IMDb. I couldn't recall if he was credited on the movie because obviously his name was there, written, directing. But I think his performance is uncredited as the father.
He's the alky dad, kind of at the bottom of the stairs, sort of screaming into
the
abyss.
The Pete Postlethwaite role.
Pete Postlethwaite role, isn't it? Yeah, and, you know, he's simultaneously tragic and terrifying.
And I mean, there's one scene where he conveys so much. There's a slope of his shoulders and a sort of stiffness of his neck that he's shot behind, and you just think, all the sorrows of the world in one shot.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, I thought, awesome bit of performance. I really like Ned's.
Yes,
and
great.
I can't quite understand why it sort of slipped through the crack a bit. I don't know why no awards for it and all that sort of stuff.
You know, you show this to BAFTA voters on their way to the Royal Opera House and, you know, they're gonna call the police.
I didn't understand a word they're saying, these children. I love the final credit sequence as well, which has all their audition pictures. They're kind of holding up their picture.
Yeah.
I mean, and you just think that's how he cast it.
Yeah.
And he is a former youth worker, Peter Mullen, himself. So I sort of, out of those little acorns, he's probably seen himself in there quite a lot.
I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure. It's a great film.
But very funny as well, I thought. Zan, tell me about Get Low. Fantastic cast.
Fantastic cast, isn't it? It's Get Low is starring Robert Duvall. Now, about this time last year, Robert Duvall cropped up in the Jeff Bridges film, Crazy Heart.
He was executive producer and had a sort of cameo.
Yeah, he had a sort of cameo. And I kind of thought, where has Duvall been? Here he is again. He's absolutely brilliant. He's like 80 now.
Yeah.
But he's still got that kind of muscular authority.
Yeah, I mean, I loved him in that film. I suppose the last great film we did was The Apostle?
Yeah.
Which I thought he was terrific.
Yeah, that he directed as well.
Yeah.
This is a sort of showcase for Duvall, and yet it's not much more than a showcase for Duvall. And on top of that, Duvall looks a little tired in it. It's based
on... He's old. You just said he's knackered.
Yeah, but he didn't seem knackered in a year ago. What's happened in that time?
He was in one scene in a boat.
he made that scene his own. He stole that film. Here, it's supposedly based on a true story of this crusty old hermit in 1930s Tennessee who wants to arrange his own funeral while he's still alive and then air some grievances and lay some ghosts to rest.
Let's have a listen to Robert Duvall telling Bill Murray what he's going to do.
You will be, I guarantee you.
I want to be there now.
You want to be at your funeral party alive?
Yes, sir.
But you can't have a funeral if you're not, deceased.
Hold on now. It's a detail. We can look at it.
Pretty big detail.
You want to have a funeral party while you're alive so you can go.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Well, it's nice to hear those two, I must say. I mean, it sounds like a match made in heaven.
Well, it should be, shouldn't it? Bill Murray is another actor that I normally adore. I think he's faintly miscast in this. He's basically the dapper, slightly scheming, small-town undertaker. And I can't really see Bill Murray as a sort of southern small-town person. He's too much... kind of big city.
Yeah,
I think.
When I first heard about this film, I haven't seen it yet, as any attentive listener will divine, I thought that Bill Murray would be playing the hermit role.
Yeah, he might have been better in that.
Quite good at that.
You've also got Sissy Spacek, who, again, I like Sissy Spacek, but she's got very little to do. And it's basically, it's building towards this big reveal that what happened in Duvall's past to make him retreat from the world and all this. And then when it comes, you think, is that's it? Really? And so there's this terrible dying fall to the film. It's corny, it's syrupy, it's a bit drowsy.
Yeah.
It's the sort of film that if you stumbled upon it on a Sunday afternoon, you know, it's a very pleasant film to nod off to.
Zan, there's a film out called Honeymooner, a British film. I'm going to tell you about it as a revenge for me.
Can you explain what does Honeymooner mean?
Well, Honeymooner, it's interestingly enough, because the lead character in this film has been dumped about 2 weeks before his wedding. So we join him actually waking up on his wedding day to what should be his honeymoon. But of course, he's been dumped, so he actually doesn't really know what to do now for the next couple of weeks because he's booked himself off work. So he spends his honeymoon moping around North London and various bars in Camden.
Sorry, did that just go on you?
It's fine.
It went all over you.
Oh, trust me, it's least of my worries.
Yeah, why? What's wrong?
You don't want me to tell you?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I was meant to have got married a couple of days ago, but it didn't work out.
Why?
Just changed my mind.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's horrendous.
Yeah, she said me and her, we were on a 95% ride.
She might have had her reason.
What, she wanted perfection?
No, maybe she was just being polite.
Well, I think she's going to regret it.
And why do you think that?
Well, I think
the strange is Mancunian boys hanging out in Kentish Town and Primrose Hill. I was like, why don't you just...
It's normally Etonians there now.
Yeah, exactly. And I was thinking, none of you can afford to live in Primrose Hill. Really not. You know, unless you're kind of Jude Law's cleaner or something. It's actually kind of it's written by Cole Spector, and it's one of these the new British film quarterlies. So it's getting distributed, and they're doing kind of a tour of it. And it's something I really kind of applaud that kind of initiative. We saw it with the film 1, 2, 3, 4, and Skeletons as well was one of those as well, which Nick Whitfield just got a BAFTA nomination for. So I kind of was really wishing the best for this film, and it's got a very kind of I would sort of say Woody Allen-ish kind of turn to it. It's a kind of neurotic urban rom-com in a way. It could be Friends if you like, but it's descended from that, yet set in this kind of Kentish Town Camden mix.
Sounds all right. It sounds a bit like The Lowdown, remember that?
Yeah, well, I that's what I thought it might be. It doesn't quite have the filmic kind of interest of Jamie Thrace, which has a bit of Godard thrown in between his Woody Allen-ness. This one, you know, I'm thinking, God, it all sounds all right, and it just isn't funny enough, or it just isn't charming enough to quite merit the attention. I never really laughed, and I was thinking, well, what else am I doing? Because I'm not crying, and I'm not really bleeding, and it should be that surreal bit. There's a bit with Primrose Hill where he comes across his ex, who's just dumped him, who's played by Lisa Faulkner, and she's got a new boyfriend whose name she doesn't even know, and he's crushed a bit. It's not really
played
very
funny. She doesn't know the name of the boyfriend? No, she's got problems,
she
hasn't she?
Really has.
That's the real story.
And why she's dumped this guy. I mean, he's such a... No, he's a loser. I don't blame her. She's gorgeous. Did you remember the 80s?
I do vaguely remember the 80s. Much like the girl who can't remember the name of her boyfriend, some of it is fading.
Yeah, well, that's because you were there.
I was there.
Now, you mentioned Billy Idol as well, but you'll remember back then there was also Video Nasties.
I do remember Video Nasties. I know where you're going with this.
The
story that I remember about I Spit on Your Grave was when videos first came, and a friend of mine from school got a video, and we were all very excited about this. And then as part of a special offer, they got a video thrown into play on the video. And the video was I Spit on Your Grave.
No.
So this friend of mine sat with his grandparents and parents and stuck in I Spit on Your Grave.
No.
Yeah. So, you know, imagine the horror of that.
Well, that's an extraordinary thing to happen, because it was banned.
It was banned. It was a video nasty. Yeah. But this was obviously in the sort of the 2 weeks before banned.
Yeah, maybe.
And probably might have even been banned because of the furore at the suburban house in Somerset.
Yeah, that he got with his, what were they, Toshibas, JVCs.
Yeah, Betamax.
Yes. Well, it was banned in 1984 as part of that. I think there were loads of them banned as well. But there's been a vogue for remaking them at the moment and re-releasing. So there's a re-release of the actual Your Mates videos out on DVD as well, but there's actually
I'll send it to him.
We'll send him the remake as well, see what he makes of it. I mean, it is a classic hillbilly backwards story in which, you know, a pretty girl from the city goes to hire a cabin in the woods to write a novel. Someone least likely to write a novel I've never seen in my life, but anyway, so she does a bit of sunbathing, takes a bikini top off, and this, of course, justly excites the local hillbillies.
What, who want to read the novel?
They're desperate for her novel. They want to. They do nick her laptop and try and kind of see what she's writing and kind of don't really understand it. And that is the reason, sort of, that they brutally gang rape her, including the local sheriff. And then she disappears and then comes back and exacts brutal revenge on them with fish hooks and kind of garrotting and garden shears to the penis.
Now, is this, talking of misogyny, is this a misogynist atrocity, or is it a girl power revenge thriller?
You ask a question, Zan, that I cannot answer, because such is the brilliant slippery morality of
ambiguity.
The filmmaking. No, it's absolute fucking dim. It is meritless. It is meretricious. It is a vile piece of work, I have to say. And I don't
know. So it lives up or lives down to the original?
Well, I think the original, it is a very dim memory for me as well. I haven't actually seen the reissue on DVD. I do know that the British censors were more troubled by this reissue, I Spit on Your Grave, than by any other film this year. And whether they've slashed it beyond any kind, I don't know I don't know why anyone would watch it, because it's not like, ugh, that's horrible.
Yeah,
it's just like that's
because a lot of those films that were lumped in as video nasties were things like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and stuff, which were Evil Dead, which are great films,
properly good films.
But this one, from what I can remember, wasn't.
No, it was very, very simple, and I think they've remade it in exactly the same spirit.
So why have they remade it?
I have no idea. I spit on their grave wholeheartedly. In fact, I micturate on their grave. Upon which note, a huge thanks to Zan Brooks, of course, for all of Zan's insightful writings on film and his videos. Go to guardian.co.uk/film. But now, on Film Weekly, time for something completely different. Josh, hit it. Bravo, or whatever the banjo equivalent of it is. Josh Fox is there on banjo. When Josh is not picking strings, he's picking fights with the gas industry in the US. See what I did there, Josh?
That's nice. Josh, I like that.
Welcome to Film Weekly. Josh Fox is the director, writer and star of Gasland, a documentary which sets out to shine a light on the situation of gas in the US currently. Josh, we heard your banjo there, which accompanies you on your journey around America and the kind of... The fracking of natural gas, which is it seems to be the right instrument. Obviously, you as a filmmaker, you know, you want to put your skills out there.
Yeah, well, the banjo is a good road trip companion,
isn't it? But it is an instrument about the heartland of America as well, which is what your film is getting to.
I guess it does. I mean, it is. It always feels like it opens up a door into a different way of thinking about America, and I think that helps. You know. And you know it's great to be able to play the banjo on the radio, because I often just have to talk about gas drilling, and it's a lot more fun.
It does light
to play
the
banjo, you know, than to talk about these horrible things that are happening to people all over the United States.
The extraordinary thing is, Josh, were you what I couldn't get from the film was, were you a filmmaker to start with, or was it the fact that this gas company wanted to buy your land to do their gas exploration that forced you into it?
Yeah, well, I've never made a documentary before. I've made one previous feature film, and I've made 25 or so different plays that have premiered in New York and around the world with my company, International Wow Company. So I'm used to creating stories. Mm. This was a little bit different, though, because this is a documentary. It's sort of like doing the research phase for one of like a play I might write or work on with my company. But the story is that, you know, I got this gas lease. And different approaches from gas companies to lease my family's land in the Upper Delaware River Basin of Pennsylvania. It's right on the border of New York. It's part of the interconnected watershed system that brings water from this beautiful, pristine area in the Catskills.
Gorgeous.
Down in the Delaware River Basin, down to New York City and Philadelphia and southern New Jersey. So it's a beautiful area. It's in, there's nature. It's, you know, it's not developed. It's not a suburb. It's the woods.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, we are over a formation called the Marcellus Shale, and this is shale gas. It's a shale gas revolution. That's what they're calling it. Essentially, Halliburton, everybody's favorite company of mine.
which Dick Cheney was in charge of before he became vice president.
Dick Cheney was the CEO from 95 till 2000, right up to when he became the vice president. They invented a new form of drilling. I think of it as a kind of turbo drilling. It's called hydraulic fracturing or fracking. The fracking actually injects huge amounts of water into rock formations that hold gas. That water is infused with toxic chemicals. There's about 600 different chemicals that they use, the majority of which are carcinogens and neurotoxins and all these horrible chemicals that you can't pronounce. And that it breaks apart the rock formation at pressures that rival cluster bombs. So it's this mini earthquake under the ground created by water. And that frees up the gas. The problem is that this is a very intense industrialization process. When you're there, the ground rumbles, it shakes, and that these chemicals start turning up, lo and behold, in people's water supply.
And they wanted to do this in your backyard.
They're doing it all over the United States
right
now.
And you're just a microcosm. You're just like one idyllic back garden that they wanted to do this to.
At one time when we were going through all the gurgling in the well, mm-hmm. I decided to put a plastic bag over the wellhead. Mm-hmm. And with minutes, it filled up that bag. Mm-hmm. So I closed off the bag and I stuck a fuse in it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this might be real stupid. So I came in and I told Marcia, I said, why don't you dial 9-1? And if this doesn't go right,
hit the other one.
Hit the other one. So I got this bag.
I guess the money shots of your film, which I just went blimey in a very English way, was when people they went to the, you went to the house. They said, "Come into my garage. I'm going to turn on my faucet or tap, we call it in this country." They hold a cigarette lighter to it and poof,
right.
It just goes up. I mean, it's like a miracle. It's like the water's on fire. I'm like, hallelujah, brothers. I mean, it was amazing.
Well, the first time you see that your world does completely turn upside down, because water is not supposed to light on fire.
No.
And it begs the question,
Jesus,
well, if you had a fire in your house, how would you put it out? You know, and this actually happened to people, that they had a fire on in their brush fire in the front lawn, and they could not use the fire hose to put it out. But this was very common. This is something that I've heard reports of all over gas drilling territory. And let me tell you, this is an incredible, huge amount of territory in the United States, in 34 states. And we weren't just talking about my little backyard. It was half of New York State, 65% of Pennsylvania, half of Ohio, all of it was huge, huge. And this is the same kind of proposal that is actually proposed for the UK, for a big area in the Northeast of the United Kingdom.
Right.
Well, as our situation for energy needs to change, and as the companies who produce fossil fuel find less and less of it in conventional sources, they're doing these unconventional ways of drilling. And it's really a desperation technique. It's a desperation technique because it is so extreme and so polluting, and it really isn't even economically viable. So in order to make it economically viable, Dick Cheney and the likes found ways to propose bills that were then passed in the United States Congress 2005 to exempt this form of drilling from our most basic and fundamental environmental laws, like the Safe Drinking Water Act.
And the Clean Air Act.
And the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, our Superfund Act, which is about toxic cleanup. So they're creating these toxic sites all over the world, and they're exempt from this. I mean, in the United States, they're exempt. And then, of course, this model is passed on as a successful model of energy production.
What your film does, it kind of goes all the way to the top with Dick Cheney, and, you know, and you unashamedly and unreservedly you point the accusing finger at him and say, well, you invented this and you're fracking up the planet.
Well, it goes further than that. I mean, there is a whole system at work here. And then when you watch at the end of the film these congressional hearings on fracking, which are still, by the way, inconclusive. They haven't changed these laws. You watch the gas industry and their lobbyists essentially lie to Congress. It's interesting. I did sort of turn into a gas drilling detective because there was so little information about this. And the reason why is because when they come to you to offer you these leases, they're not upfront. They don't say you could have environmental damage. In fact, they do the opposite. They say, oh, it's just a fire hydrant in the middle of your field. You're going to make a lot of money. Everything's going to be hunky-dory. But then when you start looking into it, there's these toxic chemicals and there's air pollution. And the health hazards from living near these kinds of toxic industrial sites, which quickly crisscross the landscape, pipelines, compressor stations, condensate tanks, drilling rigs. You really industrialize and contaminate that whole atmosphere.
Yeah, and your aerial shots are devastating. I mean, the company that's distributing your film, Dogworth, have done much to show us about the Alberta tar sands.
Tar sands is one of those issues that is like what I'm talking about, this desperation. But shale gas is, I think, more widespread and in ways more significant than tar sands, because you're talking about what they're proposing to keep fossil fuels running the world for the next 50 years. Shale gas has been described as the mortal enemy of renewable energy technology. And the report that just came out in Britain in concert with the opening of the film on the 17th by the cooperative basically talks about it in terms of climate change, not just in terms of all these water contamination issues and all the problems with living in these areas because they become unlivable, but actually if you're going to be developing natural gas as a primary source of fuel, you're going to be contributing a lot of carbon dioxide and a lot of methane because methane escapes into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And they're pointing this out as the fundamentally wrong direction to go in for the energy future, and is the competitor with the green energy, with the renewable energy that many of us really want to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Developed. And it's so it is a battle for the soul of the planet as well, which and I think your film has so much in it that it's extraordinary. And you're a very nice company throughout. Josh, I love to hear the banjo
sure.
Whenever I can. I'm not going to duel with you, which I think would be very cinematic of me, but I'm useless on it. So
you can make some noise.
Can I do some maybe spoon playing on the knee? No, we're not Appalachians here. What we'll do is if you could just give us another couple of licks, Josh. Give us that heartland of America feeling, because we're all in it together and we're all kind of fighting the villains together. So some music, if you would, please.
Sure, Maestro. And thanks very much for having me.
Josh Fox's Gasland is on limited release here in the UK already. And if you want to find out more about the campaign and the film, do check out their website. There's a special UK-based one, gaslandthemovie.co.uk. At which point, we must stop gassing for this week. The music we've been featuring on the podcast this week includes the brittle and brilliant score to Black Swan by British composer Clint Mansell, helped by Tchaikovsky, of course, as well as the beautiful banjo playing of documentarist Josh Fox, who's been live in the studio with me. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday. Trailer Trash is back after my paternity leave. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, we'll see you next week.
Once.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.